Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here. I've had the opportunity in the last 7 months to visit Australia several times, and many people at home ask me what it's like here, and it's easy to point to the diversity of the people and the geography and the absolute stunning natural beauty and the great business climate. But the thing that I always answer with first is how terrific the people are. I felt welcome from Brisbane to Perth, here in Melbourne, everywhere I visit has been very welcoming to me, and I sincerely appreciate that. It's a terrific environment. Let's see. Here's the title for the presentation today. PPPs. I'm going to cover some of public-private partnerships in the U.S. Some history, and is it the future, or is it fading out? Here's the tagline. Despite the significant progress we've made in alternative delivery progress in the U.S., the future is in doubt, and you've already heard many of the reasons why: the constrained capital markets, procurement regulations, costs, and I'll touch on some of those. But it's much the same in the States, although I would say the States are a good 30 years behind the UK in PPP development, and certainly well behind Australia as well. This is the outline of the presentation. You can see the points that I'm going to cover today. I'll make a not-so-bold prediction at the end. A little bit about URS Corporation. For those of you who don't know us, you can see the growth curve for URS Corporation. We, like many companies, are an amalgamation of several engineering and construction companies. My legacy company is the Morrison Knutson Company, which has a long history here in Australia. Projects like the Melbourne Airport runway back in the 60s. We constructed most of the major rail lines in the Pilbara back in the early 70s. We became Washington Group International, which was acquired by URS in 2007. Here in Australia Pacific, we've got about 1,500 employees in Asia Pacific, I'm sorry. And we've got more than 50,000 people worldwide. Our revenues in 2008 were about $10 billion. In Australia, we are a major engineering firm doing environmental and engineering services. Our major markets, you can see, are the traditional transportation, mining, water, oil and gas, and infrastructure. Part of my role coming to Australia is to develop the EPCM capability that we have. We have three divisions within URS, and the Washington Group, the Washington division is essentially the execution arm, the project execution arm, so we plan on bringing that here and build our EPCM services in the mining and transportation and rail and highway markets. Some of the URS legacy projects here, I'm not sure how easy that is to read. Some of the URS legacy projects here in the state, we've been involved in many of the biggest PPPs in the country, highlighted by the two at the bottom. The one on the bottom, the Hudson Bergen Light Rail and facility, was the first design, build, operate, maintain project in the U.S. That's a project where we did the design, construction, and then we actually operate that rail line right now. So we actually hire the drivers, and we have a concession to essentially do that for the next 20 years. The bottom, the other one on the bottom, is the Dulles Metro project, which is a very large rail PPP from essentially Washington, D.C. out to the local airport. That project, when complete, will be the largest PPP in the country, about $5 billion when it's complete. You've probably all seen or familiar with slides like this one showing the alternative delivery methods and starting to understand the timing for PPP development in Australia. But the point of this slide is that the U.S. didn't make a transition to the right at all until about 2003. So the development of PPPs in the U.S. has been very slow. And I'll touch on some of the reasons why, but long-term leases and design, build, finance, operate projects have recently come into fold, and then we hit the economic turmoil. I learned a new acronym when I came to, believe it or not, to Australia, was GFC. I said, "What's GFC?" They said, "You're from the States, the global financial crisis you created." So you'd think I would have known that one earlier. Drivers for alternative delivery approaches in the U.S., the ASCE, the first point here is the American Society of Civil Engineers. They estimate over $2.2 trillion of repairs and upgrades are needed to the existing system in the next 5 years. to maintain, you know, the existing highway and rail systems. The total federal investment for this is rail, highway, and airport in 2008 was $42.2 billion. Now, put that in some context with the economic stimulus package here. Big numbers coming out of the U.S., and it's $780 billion, and it's a great big number. How much of that is actually going to the same market, infrastructure? The total is about $48 billion over 2 years. So while President Obama's can be very commended for you know, making the investment and focusing on it, it's really only about, on an annual basis, about a 50% increase for 2 years. And it will have some effect. It will help push some projects forward, but it certainly is not a solution to the economic crisis. You can see some of the other drivers, you know, a growing population base. The U.S. is still the first world country, it's one of the fastest growing countries. And at a higher level, you know, they reduced, and there's been a gradual decline as the population's age, that money's being diverted for social infrastructure and social programs and not for investments in major infrastructure. Most of you probably don't know that states in the U.S., you hear of, you know, the federal government can seem to go into debt wildly and print money to no end. The states in the U.S. can't run deficits. So the states have to balance their budgets every year, which really constrains the states from investing because they've only got so much money. If you read the press at all about California, and I'll have the number wrong, but California had to close they just recently passed their budget, but they were $22 billion in debt, just the state of California. So they had to balance that by, you know, cutting programs and whatever so they could project for this year that they would break even. Let's see, I already touched on the economic stimulus package. So near-term projects, there will be several projects that will get a boost. There will be some projects that don't have funding, so in the short term, it'll have a little bit of an uptick. I'll talk a little bit about the history of PPP development in the U.S. You know, the timeline from transition from fixed price to some PPP concessions, it's been a very long one. The really first state to start something like this was Florida, where they established a separate entity, if you will, to run the Florida Turnpike to raise money, and then they collected that money and they built future highways with that. Really, the most significant amount, or the significant first legislative action, was in Virginia for the Public-Private Transportation Act, and a well thought out, measured legislation that allowed for unsolicited proposals to be turned in and for solicited PPPs. And what that did initially was started some of these creation of tax-exempt entities to there were tax-exempt entities created, consortiums formed, and essentially what that did is it allowed the first wave of PPPs. I'll show you what that looks like. You can see the four projects at the bottom that were the first four real PPPs in the U.S. All of these presentations need to have an eye chart, so this is mine. If you can't read that, this is the typical tax-exempt entity structure where you've got a special purpose company, which is a not-for-profit entity. For example, in Denver, it's the E-470 Highway Authority. So they're not-for-profit. They go up for non-recourse revenue financing based on the predicted toll revenues for that road. And then any excess revenue that's generated is you know, paid down the debt. So from 1995 to 2002, what we had in the states was many states enacted design build legislation, which for the U.S. was a big step. Here you call it design construct, but most states didn't even have that legislation. In fact, some today don't even have design build legislation. But from 1995 to 2002, many big states did move to design build and some alternative deliveries. And you can see the list of projects. There are some significant projects were constructed during that time. Our firm was involved in the one in Utah, which was a $1.3 billion reconstruction of a major highway, getting ready for the 2002 Olympics. And then Colorado, they called that the T-Rex program. The Los Angeles Metro was a project that we led. And you can see the other projects. The one at the bottom was the one that was one of our flagship rail projects, which was the Design, Build, Operate, Maintain project in New Jersey. And then following these, this really, PPP momentum was really starting to gather. States were starting to look at additional legislation and how they can be more creative, raise more capital, use alternative methods. And so 2003 to 2008, we started moving toward more full concession. There's really two types of concessions in the U.S., and the first one is new capacity concessions. The most sweeping legislative action was in the state of Texas. Texas created broad PPP concession type legislation to encourage firms to come in, invest money, and construction companies and engineering companies to focus on concessions. What they created was was legislation that allowed regional counties and authorities to create what they called regional mobility alliances. So Texas is a very geographically large state, much like some of the states, not as big as some of the states in Australia, of course, but very big state, major population centers scattered. So they're trying to connect these cities a little bit better so that we'd have regional mobility alliances. So say the city of Houston could create their own RMA, and they could then enact their own authority to go build a new toll road, collect the tolls, raise the money, raise the capital themselves. So that allowed a lot of several major projects to be to start. Texas also had a really interesting vision, the governor did, to create these super corridors, which they called the Trans-Texas Corridor. And these super corridors were, I can't remember, 200 meters wide, and they had rail, highway, pipeline, utilities. So they wanted to put all of this in a major corridor, a big vision. And actually, one of these corridors was actually contracted for in 2005, called the Trans-Texas Corridor 35. And you can see the 50-year development, and the concessionaire actually makes payments over that 50 years to Texas in the form of $1.2 billion. And that, and then they operate and maintain those highways over that same time period. So that's a stepped procurement for a major, or a stepped construction of a major highway. Then the other significant move was in 2007, where Virginia signed the 495 Capital Beltway, which is a ring road around Washington D.C. to one of the major participants there was Transurban, an Australian firm. And that's a 80-year concession. And so that, and then just recently, I know in the economic crisis, Florida closed on the financing of a $1.6 billion design, build, operate, maintain, which was the first availability concession in the U.S. So some progress. The second type of concession in the U.S. is the really concession of existing assets, which is taking existing tollways, bridges, and then leasing those on a long-term basis. You can see some of the big numbers here. City of Chicago leased the Sunshine Skyway for $1.8 billion, and then right on the heels of that, the state of Indiana, which is the highway that connects to this bridge, leased their 250-kilometer Indiana toll road for $3.8 billion. And they used those assets to actually go fund their other construction programs. A couple of other programs that were in the same vein were the Pocahontas Parkway and the Northwest Parkway, both turned into long-term leases. Now, the talk we had earlier about financial or federal programs that encourage public-private, we have two major programs here. One is what they call private activity bonds, which is essentially federal government loans at no interest. And that's one program that we have. The one that Transurban closed recently was $589 million of that. $1.8 billion was used from a private activity bond by the government, and that's a $15 billion pool that the federal government holds. The other major program is the TIFIA, which is the Transportation Infrastructure Finance and Innovation Act, and if you say that three times fast, I can't do it. But it provides, again, federal credit assistance, and it can take the form of subordinated debt, senior debt, a loan guarantee. So it's a really flexible instrument, and that's another $15 billion pool of money that the federal government has, that it can use at its discretion on jobs, and it can be used for up to 33% of the cost. And virtually all major concessions and PPPs in the U.S. have used some TIFIA loan money, again on the Capital Beltway, the one that Transurban closed on in 2007, was $588 million of TIFIA loans in addition to the private activity bonds. And by the way, the TIFIA loans are subordinate to the private activity bonds. But so on that program, you've got $1 billion of essentially zero interest money from the federal government on that $1.8 billion project. This graph shows states with a significant PPP authority. You know, and the point here is that, and I heard this earlier in the conversation, was that somebody talking about consistency of a PPP procurement process and procedures and rules and regulations. Well, the U.S. is a great place with 50 states and 50 different rules, and so there are no two rules that are the same when it comes to PPP. Some are very broad, like Texas, very broad and sweeping, and you know, basically bring the money and we'll figure out a way to do it. And then some are extremely restrictive, like California, which had a very prescriptive four-project demonstration program, and that was it. So there really are states in the U.S. that are the leaders of concessions are Florida, Texas, and Virginia, and then to some extent behind that, Utah, Colorado, and some other states. I'm going to talk about some of the challenges to the concession model. A lot of this you've heard from other speakers already. Public perception is a big one in the U.S. A term I use called political sustainability, and that's the can a project survive political regime turnover. And if you look to invest in a project like that or procure a project like that or pursue a PPP, what happens if the governor doesn't survive? Or in this case, the premier. If the premier doesn't survive, will the next one support this project? Because it comes down to that kind of level in the U.S. And there's a real difference in a public versus a private concession cost. And then the investment, Wal King touched on this earlier, the investment required by engineering and contractor firms is very high. And then really, what's the value for the concession of existing assets, and is that really appropriate? You know, you can see here with some of the exceptions, user fee facilities, toll roads primarily in the U.S. are not generally accepted practice, except for the states I listed there, which are Florida, New York, Virginia, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Texas. And those are major population centers, and so there are, you know, a high use of tolling facilities, but most of the other states don't even have a toll road in them, or a tollway, or a toll bridge. So then, you know, trying to enact, you can enact the great legislation, but the public ability, the ability to, for the politicians to sell to the public, well, you need this highway, and now we're going to charge you for that. For using that road is a pretty tough sell for the politicians. Traditionally they coined the term freeways because they're free, and that's been a hard for the population to move off of that. And there's this sense of entitlement that we pay our taxes to have roads built. Well, why should I pay on top of that in a double taxation? So there's that type of a belief amongst a lot of folks. And there's somewhat of a nationalistic view of, if we lease these assets, long-term assets to foreign owners, we're going to have foreign ownership of our assets, even though, of course, that's not correct. Lease is not ownership, but not understood by the public very well. Touching on political sustainability, many good projects have died on the first week in November. We've had, and that's when our traditional voting cycle is. And what happens is there was a project in the state of Georgia, which was a ring road, an attachment to a ring road, provided a terrific public benefit, but it became a political issue in the campaign. Governor got beat, project went down in flames. The competing teams probably spent $5 million pursuing that job and never got to even tender it. So that's what we're talking about. Is the public will strong enough to push a project forward? And some transportation departments see anything innovative outside of what they do, their staff, that it's a threat to their job, and it's a threat to their business, and it's a threat to their livelihood. And so changing that mindset and changing that paradigm has been tough. We've educated several DOTs on the values and benefits, and it's a tough sell sometimes. I'll give you an example at the bottom of the project in Washington, D.C., which is the Dulles Metro project. This is a project we've been developing for 12 years, believe it or not. And this project has so much public need and public desire that it survived three different changes in governors. Even if it doesn't work financially, sometimes they'll figure out a way to make it work because they know that the public wants this project. Next challenge. This is a follow some of the discussion on, you know, capital, cost of capital, and where it is right now. If we can do a public concession on a tax-exempt entity, it's simply far less expensive to put that entity together, raise the capital, and so you don't have the cost of private equity in it. Walt King touched on this. The investment required by engineering construction firms for major PPPs is increasingly significant and a real issue when it comes to bidding time. Before my company was acquired by URS, we were pursuing a project in Denver, which was a big rail project, a rail program under a concession arrangement, and I was leading that effort, and I was doing an evaluation on what would it cost us to pursue this one project. It's probably a $2 billion per program concession. Well, there were four bidders, and we had a partnership with another a firm. We would have two partners, the engineers. Our investment for our company alone was somewhere between $10 and $15 million. And you're thinking, okay, there's three or four competitors. Is that really a good use of our money? You know, and we decided it was not. I know Wall said he spent $40 million on it on an airport. I think it was on the airport projects here. I mean, that's a significant investment for, I mean, my business development budget for my entire business unit was $7 million. So you get special dispensation for this. Pretty hard to justify in that highly competitive environment to make that investment. And we do have, you probably have stipends here or some type of stipend for your investment, but the stipend for that job was $1 million. And that didn't even pay for part of the engineering work that we had to do for that one. So we decided not to do it. This might be with the large sums of money, as I mentioned before, to pay to Chicago and Indiana, a lot of politicians stood up and said, boy, we gotta look at that and lease our existing assets and find out if that was something that they could gain value from. And the latest one to come out was the Pennsylvania Turnpike, very long established a toll road, long history of traffic, so you could predict fairly well what the concession was worth. But when it was tendered, the bid received was quite a bit below what the assessed value by the state was. And really, what this really represents, believe it or not, is that the states with these assets have been reluctant to raise tolls because it's been politically unpopular for several years. So in the case of the Indiana Toll Road, in the case of the Pennsylvania Turnpike, that the tolls hadn't been raised significantly for 10 or 20 years. And the politicians are afraid to raise the tolls to what the market will bear. So what they did is they went out for a concession to try to collect that money in advance. And when they got a low bid, they realized that, well, we still have this value, we have the asset. Well, let's go ahead and raise the tolls, and that way we'll inure the benefit ourselves without going through this process. Terrific, but it cost, you know, the bidding team millions of dollars to pursue this. So there's finally a recognition. I know it sounds simple, but there's finally a recognition that, you know, of the value of the assets and to generate money from those assets. Okay, so some of the lessons learned. I know this is a pretty straightforward stuff. For us, the public need has to be overwhelming for a project. It has to be a clear need, a viable need. It has to be solid legislation, of course, and a commitment. The line that I said, you know, the project must be demonstrate financial viability early in the process, and I don't know if you have this problem here in Australia or in Victoria, but what we see in the states is the politicians and the departments of transportation put out their marginal projects as PPPs, the projects that aren't as financially robust. And so, and then the states then build the projects that could be used as PPPs themselves. And it's just the opposite of what should occur. If there is a toll road or a new road or a greenfield project that we know would pay for itself via PPP, that's the one to develop as a PPP, and the one that's marginal is the state and the Fed should fund and build. And so we keep saying this, and we meet with many states, and we keep saying this, but that's been really hard to overcome. And hopefully that's not the case here. And again, the compensation to the engineering construction parties must be fair, or there must be a different process so that you don't have, you know, four firms putting $15 million into a bid. I think in today's market, you won't get any bids. And there has to really be that, you know, the longest pole in the tent, as we say, is the political will. There have to be political champions that stand up and say, this is the right thing to do for the citizenry, and we're going to do it. And they put their political careers on the line to make it happen. There's been many instances where that happened in the state, and those are the ones that lead to success. This is pretty, again, pretty straightforward stuff. You know, PPPs will continue in the states and anywhere where you've got the acceptance of the user fees and good legislation and knowledgeable staff and knowledgeable staff at the working level that believe in the process and want to make the process work. Oftentimes we have great legislation, but that's not passed down to the people in the departments of transportation and the staff, and they resist it. So you have to have buy-in from all the parties. And then, again, strong, committed political leadership. So that's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark, for that comprehensive overview of the position in the states for PPP. There is time for questions, so would someone would like to question Mark further on anything he said or issues in the states, please let us know. There's one on the right.
Yeah, Michael Porter, Research Director at CEDA, where we're sort of looking at some transitional strategies on these issues. I particularly liked Mark's last few slides. I think it's worth noting that, if I can make a comment, then a question. The comment is that the United States is a country with sort of massive ambiguity of ownership when you look at a lot of infrastructure. You've got pipelines, you've got transmission companies, with lines to smelters and things. The reason it all started in the UK was political will from Thatcher. The economy was stuffed and so forth. And Victoria had the same strength where our economy was stuffed back in the 80s. And we had political will. And this political will then was associated with state-owned assets. So we could have a clean sheet. So if you look at the transaction that took place in Victoria, where cricket was invented in the UK, but we did it a bit better here. I think it's the same in this privatisation process, that we really did have the chance to sit down, look at the industry, look at the regulatory requirements, look what makes predictable income, and then the super funds, some super reforms, the super funds were ready to put money in and so on and so forth. So that regulatory clean slate situation, I think, is the reason the UK and then Australia, particularly Victoria, got going. Now, that was all built around private finance, which has collapsed. So my question is, to what extent should the government now contemplate a model whereby they take a lot of the risk, build a lot of the new infrastructure, whatever that may be? It could be some broadband, could be some tunnels and bridges and loading zones for ships, in a form that will later on facilitate ready privatisation. Now, should we be thinking, in terms of what Walt King's saying, is just getting on with it with some alliance models, but with one eye on the future, so that there's some very nice assets ready for some very willing super funds, so we can sort of learn from the past that when we had clean assets, we got good private sector participation. The US is an example of sort of multiple private ownership of utilities. It's made it very difficult.
You know, I...
Just speaking to it.
I agree wholeheartedly with what Wall said about building the assets now. And you know, the value is delivered to the citizenry, the value is delivered to the populace. If you build a new, you know, cross town, well, we've got this major rail program here. Just for example, here you've got the Victoria Transport Plan, very ambitious plan, you know, $39 billion in, I can't remember how many years, 12 years. I mean, this is what I would consider to be real economic stimulus. If you look at the, you know, you've got a population here of about 3.5 million people, and if you put $40 billion of stimulus on top of that in this Victoria Transport Plan, no matter how you get there, no matter how you get there with federal funding, with state funding, you know, the benefit that's delivered out of that on a long-term basis is, you know, I'm not sure how you would measure it, because it would really promote the movement of people to and from, and create the business. It creates so much business of itself from the capital, but in the long-term growth of the state, I don't know how you'd measure it. It would be huge in economic impact. If you looked back at the U.S. in the 50s, what made the U.S. so competitive and the economy that it is, one of the key drivers was the investment in the federal highway system that Eisenhower did back in the 50s. You know, cross interstate, connecting ports, connecting all of the states, and enabling that vast and fast movement of goods and services. And you have that same here. You have that same, some of the same problems and opportunities here coming down from Queensland down to here. Get the railway aligned so it's all working functionally. I mean, that's the type of thing, the investments, I think, if the federal government makes the investment, terrific, and then lease the asset afterwards or put it up for privatization afterwards and get the money back afterwards. And the other benefit thing I would say here is, you know, you have no debt in this country. You know, you have a great opportunity to make an investment in the near term that will pay off multiple times in the long term. It's not like the U.S. that has $4 trillion or $5 trillion or some crazy number of debt. And that hampers what the U.S. can do. And, you know, if you look at the stimulus package, you know, the Victoria Transport Plan investment here is probably, the actual benefit is probably fivefold or tenfold what the $780 billion over the course of the $15 trillion economy is in the U.S. I'm not sure if I answered your question.
I think we could also add to that the CityLink project in Melbourne, which I think you could argue was built in a similar way with private money and has lifted the productivity of business in Melbourne, getting goods from one side to another dramatically.
Yeah, I mean, there are many places I've been in the country that have port expansion and port development. I mean, certainly the long-term asset and then the long-term value of port expansion, be it in Western Australia, be it in Victoria, be it in New South Wales, certainly those will pay off. And again, it really doesn't matter in the long term where you get the money from, but get it in place and get it going. And the biggest benefit, of course, in the short-term economic crisis is in job employment. You know, let's get the Victoria Transport Plan off the ground and let's go build. Let's get it to market.